Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven on WNHH-FM, New Haven's home for community radio. I'm Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Well, Toad's Place has been making New Haven tick for longer than a lot of folks listening today have been alive, since 1975. And now the story of Toad's Place has been told, thanks to the gentleman who is in our studio today. Say hello to Randall Beach, co-author with Brian Phelps of the legendary Toad's Place. I'm going to hold it up for the people watching. Stories from New Haven's famed music venue, a new book out by Globe Peacock Press. Randall Beach, welcome to Dateline New Haven. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on your show, Paul.
Good. I'm going to ask you to get so close to that mic that you're almost touching it.
Okay.
Unlike a Toad's, where they have an amazing sound system and you could probably be on your back drunk and still have a record quality sound, we do our best with what we got. So, Randall, you have a new book out. You wrote the story of Toad's Place. Brian Phelps has been running Toad's Place almost since it opened. And he wanted to tell his story, so he enlisted you to write the book with him. Tell me, how did you come about to write this book and why?
Well, it was 2 years ago, September 2019, and Brian, who I've known through the years because I covered rock and roll for the New Haven Register in the late 70s, early 80s, he emailed me and said, say, do you have any way I can get photos from the New Haven Register archives of Toad's Place shows? And I said, actually, they didn't very good job of archiving it with all the different changes in ownership. So I don't think I can really help you on that one. But what's this book about, Brian? Were you writing a book? And he said, yeah, I am. I'm writing a book about the history of Toad's Place. And I said, well, how's it going? And he said, well, not so well, because I went online and under ghostwriters, I found this group, and they're out of India.
India.
And so they're writing what the raw material I'm sending them out of my journal, and they don't seem to know much about American rock music. Like, Chucky's in Love. They don't know how to spell that. Chucky. And I said, Brian, why are you messing around with people from outside the country when I'm right here? I was at those shows. I've still got the clippings from my reviews back in a peach box in my closet. I kept it all.
What kind of box?
A peach box.
What's a peach box?
Well, it's a box you get from the grocery store that originally had peaches in it.
Okay.
And so I just put my clippings in and then...
What store was that? The Roses? Or
what?
What store was the peach box from?
Oh, I have no idea. Anyway, I said this to Brian and he said, oh yeah, that's a pretty good idea. So he got rid of
the Indian outsourcers were gone.
Sorry?
The Indian outsourcers were out of the picture.
Yeah. He.
I was just reading about that Chuck E. in Love. That's the Ricky Lee Jones hit she had, which is really good.
Yeah.
And in the book you talk about when she was here and she gave it her best here too. But apparently that was her buddy. And then they didn't stay buddies for long after the song came out.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
All right. So Brian said, okay, Randy, maybe that's a good idea. That was 2 years ago. What happened next?
Well, we met at Maury's and kind of
Maury's.
He likes hanging out next door to Toad's at Maury's. It's one of his go-to places. He likes the people there. They like him. And so we had lunch and talked about how we might approach this. He showed me his 100-page journal he had kept of just his memories of the main shows through the years.
Really, he kept the journal like from the beginning? Because Brian Phelps wasn't the founder of Toad's. Mike Spurndle was. Mm-hmm. He was the visionary. Very moving part of the book is Mike descending through his drug problems and eventually dying, but Brian was the guy who learned the business from him, really kept it going, and then learned how to be good at it, and he's been the guy running Toad's Place.
That's right. In terms of the journal, it's my understanding from Brian that at some point he had to have a knee replacement operation, and so while he was laid up at home, he started writing down anything he could remember from his years there. And he handed me this 100-page journal outline, and I looked at it and said, well, this is enough to get really be the foundation of the book, and it's going. So we can build on it from there. And so this involved my having him over my house in East Rock, New Haven, a lot, and just sitting on our back deck and saying, flesh, tell me more about that show, Brian. Tell me more. And he's a great storyteller. So he would tell me about those shows and the funny stuff he remembered. And the more I worked on this, the more I realized, well, gee, we got to have a chapter on PLR. That was so important. We got to have a chapter on Yale and its connection to Toads. And we certainly have to have a lot on Mike Sperndel. He was such an interesting guy, and the story is so tragic. So I talked to Mike's brother, who's still in Ohio, where Mike came from.
So you did a combination of hearing Brian tell his story from his journal. You interviewed him more to flesh out the story. And then you went out doing what you've done for a career, which would be a reporter.
That's
you interviewed
right.
People who knew Mike Sperndel, who died. My favorite part of the book, actually, is when you interview the people who worked there, the bouncers, and why they worked there and what it meant to be there and how they actually did their work combined with the fun of having all these stars. Just so for the few listeners who might not know, Toad's Place is on York Street. It's a rock nightclub. It started in 1975 after a failed attempt to make it a French restaurant. And it came at the right time. It was a time when a lot of rock music was becoming very mainstream and widely. You can go in the business with it, with a rock club. And college students were gravitating toward the place. It became a place where a lot of people on their way up to stardom would play, as well as local bands. Got a national reputation as one of the best clubs to play in the country. And it has a fantastic sound system and people who know how to run a nightclub. They handle large numbers of people. And they've stayed in business when a lot of people have come and gone out of business. And really been one of the places that give New Haven a name, the way Sally's Pizza does, or Pepe's, or Claire's, and places like that. Fair summary?
That's good. That's all accurate. That's
so was it fun writing this book? First of all, you started the book while you're still a reporter for the New Haven Register. You've been a journalist in New Haven since the 70s.
Right. It was difficult because once we got the deal with Globe Pequot in January.
I'm going to ask you to get close to that mic.
January 2020, we pitched it to Globe Pequot because I knew they were out of Guilford and published books of regional interest. When I went in there with Brian started telling his stories, and they got really turned on by all that backstage stuff. So as of January 2020, we had worked up a deal. So I had to balance still working the New Haven Register with doing the interviews. And
you covered courts for the Register in this tier column.
Courts.
So, and then the courts went online. Everything got a little crazy because the pandemic started.
Yeah, when the pandemic came in, I continued to work on this. And fortunately, I got some extensions on the on my deadline for the book. And November of last year, I was offered an opportunity. All employees at Hearst were offered the chance.
Hearst owns the New Haven Register.
Right. To do a buyout. And, I was 70 years old and really working hard in this book and needing to find time to really bring it home.
I don't know if I had the energy, to tell you the truth. Like, when I wrote a book, I took off from my day job, and I was still tired. I had little kids. But I don't know at our age if I'd be able to have a full-time reporting job and write a book at the same time. I'd be wiped out.
Well, what saved me, that's one of the reasons I took the buyout. And so as of the end of November, I could work full-time on this book all day long into the night. And my final deadline was late January. So by then I was really cooking day after day and was able to, I think, do everything I needed to do for the
book. When you drafted chapters, would you run them by Brian? Because his name goes first.
Oh,
it's in
yes.
the first person.
Everything I showed to Brian to get his okay on it. The collaboration worked very well. We disagreed on, we did very much agree on the approach and how to tell it. So he was really good to work with.
Were there any points of disagreement? There must have been as collaborators.
At one point, we were trying to list all the bands in the back of the book, and he didn't necessarily want to list every band.
Right, 999's not in there. Because I think one of the most fun things about this book is you go at the end and you look at all the shows at Toads.
Yeah.
And you go through and see the ones you saw and the ones you liked. So I had a lot of time going through that, and then I couldn't find 999 anywhere, the English punk band, which is one of my favorite shows I ever saw there.
Yeah, because... Again, we're at the mercy of record keeping, and especially in the mid-70s, late-70s, not everything was written down, not everything was preserved or documented.
It's a pretty good list, though. It goes on for pages, so we get a flavor of who played there.
It's a great list. So, but I just said, we should put in everybody in that list who you know played there. And, they were there. So.
And that's quite a list you'll see. It's basically a survey of American music in the last part of the 20th century, beginning 21st. The book is called The Legendary Toad's Place. Stories from New Haven's famed music venue by Brian Phelps and Randall Beach. Randall's here in the studio with us here on Dateline New Haven, WNHH 103.5 FM. We're live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. So one of the choices you made and agreed on is that the book would be in the first person.
Right.
So it's Brian telling his story.
Yep.
At times, you quote Randall Beach a lot. So a lot of times you'll say, that's you.
Yeah.
So you'll say Randall Beach because a lot of this book comes from your reviews you wrote.
Yeah.
How did you feel about that? How did you decide how to do that?
It just evolved that way. It just seemed to make sense since he really had written a lot of this bare bones journal in the first person. It seemed difficult to suddenly start switching it just because we're in chapter two or three, or just because
that's his story.
It's me. It's his story, so I wanted to keep it in his words as much as possible. And
was it fun writing the book?
Oh yeah, it was. It was fun because I'd been there. I'd been in a lot of those shows. It was interesting to hear how he pulled off this stuff, and finding out more about Mike Spurner, who I didn't know very well at all.
He once threatened to rent a septic tank and put it on my front lawn. He didn't like something I wrote about the sticky floor at Toad's, but we made up.
Yeah. But yeah.
What was your favorite moment when you're writing the book?
I have to say the funniest thing was when I was able to find the Sons of Bob, who were the opening act for the Stones.
So was that 89, the Stones?
August 12th, 1989.
So that was one of the most famous shows in Toad's history, along there with Billy Joel doing a show and Bob Dylan doing a five-hour show. Right. The Stones wanted to test out their, they hadn't played for years, and they wanted to test out their new tour before starting. Was it Wheels Tour?
Steel Wheels.
Steel Wheels.
Yeah.
So they played at Toad's. It was kept a secret except to some of Mike's friends. Randy got in and wrote about it. And a local band called Sons of Bob played.
Yeah.
But who's Bob, by the way, in Sons of Bob?
Well, the funny thing is, these are four guys out of North Brantford. I think one of them's from Brantford. And they all happen to have fathers who are named Robert.
Wow.
Oh, Bob. Sons of Bob. Why not?
That's funny.
And
it's hard to get an original name for a rock band.
Yeah.
And that one actually has a point.
it's true. I was able to track down James Polisky and Ted Canning, two of the members of the Sons. And I just had so much fun talking to them about that week and that night and how they
and it was not a long-lived band, right?
Sons
of Bob weren't around for very long.
No, they were. They didn't.
So this was like a high point in your life. Like you're now, they're probably, absolutely, I'm guessing, in their 60s now or 50s.
They're about 24 years old
at the time.
And they get a call from Mike Spurndle. They had actually played at Toad's.
One of their parents was friends with Mike Spurndle, correct?
Yeah. So Mike obviously knew who they were and liked their sound. And Mick Jagger, who's calling the shots, said, I need an opening act. I want there to be an opening act for us. So Mike said, all right, I'll get you an opening act. And he called up Ted Canning and James Polisky. They're hanging around their apartment. And he was in West Haven and says, what are you guys doing Saturday night? I got a gig for you. And they said, well, thanks, but we...
They were playing a place near the Southern. Was it the Owl's Nest or something?
Yeah. Long gone. And they felt bad about breaking the gig. And Mike said, well, this is a big deal. This is Jim Coplick's 40th birthday party.
Jim Coplick's the big promoter.
The promoter. Yeah. And that was the cover story they were using instead of, the Stones. And so they said, well, Mike, you really need to think about this. He said, well, you got 20 minutes, and if you don't call me back, the show's off. Your gig is off, and I'll give it to somebody else. So Mike slams down the phone, and Canning and Polinsky saying, geez, what are we even talking about this for? Let's just call back and say, yeah, I mean, Jim Coplick's a pretty big deal. Let's do it. So they call back and say, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to break over the gig. We'll do this show for Coplick and for you guys. And they didn't find out for sure. They heard some rumors about what could be happening, that they might be opening for the Stones. They didn't know for sure till they got there that afternoon.
And they see the equipment being loaded.
Yeah, very heavy-duty, fancy equipment. Matter of fact, their equipment was brought into Toad's, which they had never seen happen before. They said, what's this about? And they get in, they see the expanded stage, and it just screamed Rolling Stones.
And they weren't allowed out, right? You're not allowed to call anyone to tell people they're coming, so they're kind of trapped in Toad's for 9 hours. And
Spurndle came up and he said, do you know who you're opening for tonight? No, who? You're opening for the Rolling Stones. And after they try to recover from that, he said, and you can't leave. You can't call any of your friends. All the payphones have been taped down. This is before cell phones. So it's about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, because the Stones are really worried that if the word got out and the place was swarmed over, they wouldn't go do it. They were just going to keep on driving down York Street and say, no, you didn't keep the secret well enough, so we're split. We're not doing it. So that was the fear on the behalf of the Toad's staff, that if we don't keep enough of a lid on it,
Show went well, but the word finally got out, and there were hundreds of people outside listening, which just sounds pretty good out on York Street when you hear the music.
Brian, seeing what was happening, you couldn't let anybody in after about 500 people were in there, because that's the Stones just wanted that kind of a crowd. He was smart enough, nice enough to open up the windows and doors. So the crowd.
It's one of those moments that make New Haven like a memorable New Haven night, like when the Stones came to New Haven for an intimate show. Yeah, I got to see when. And did you like the show?
Did I like the show itself? Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I mean, what's not to like?
Well, at the beginning of a tour, when there's new material, I think that bands are often kind of excited about what they're doing, and it has a little extra oomph.
Yeah, and they hadn't played together in 8 years live. They hadn't played. They just, you know, they'd had some disagreements with the band, and so finally here they're about ready to go back on. And so that's one of the funniest things I heard from Sons of Bob, was they're backstage after doing their 30 minutes. And here come the Rolling Stones tromping down the stairs. Holy shit, I hear Mick Jagger's voice. And so then, hi, Keith. Hi, Mick. How you doing?
And they're just talking. Keith Richards chatted with them, right?
They just chatted. And then Ronnie Woods, they're nervously smoking on a cigarette, said, do you think, well, how did it go up there? How did it go with your show? Oh, fine, good crowd. Well, do you think they're going to dig us? Do you think they're going to be into us? And the son said, are you kidding? You're going to fucking tear the roof off the place. You're the Rolling Stones. And Ronnie says, oh, good. Because he was actually relieved. He didn't know after 8 years. Are they still going to dig us? It was so funny.
Then I guess it was 89. Oh, no, beginning January 90, was it? When Bob Dylan came, he had a new album, new tour, Oh Mercy, which in my opinion was, he hadn't put out a really good album for about 8 years. And that was a really good one with Daniel Lanois. Hell Energy. He was touring with G.E. Smith's band, which was pretty high-powered, and he wanted to test out before playing the bigger arena, so he played Toad's.
Right.
And that famous night, it was a Friday night. That's back when I still went out Friday night. They played from 8 at night until 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
And he was, like, high energy, connecting with the crowd, because, as you know, you've seen, as I have, Dylan's shows where he's connecting a crowd, where he's not. He tries different risks that work or don't work. He was on fire that night.
He was taking requests.
That was so exciting.
You want to hear Dancing
in the dark. That was hilarious. Scene.
Yeah. He'd turn his back and work out the chords with the other guys, and then they'd play it. It was just, and he was laughing and smiling. And every time he would take a break, he'd go downstairs, and Brian would come down and say, well, so how you doing? What do you want to do? And Dylan would say, can we play some more? Can we do another set? And Brian said, well, sure. And this went on and on, 4 or 5 sets until 2:20 in the morning. And Brian, he had to shut down the bar, but there were enough cops there that he knew the show, club was not going to be, closed down, because the cops are enjoying the show.
Yeah, that was a great show. And we're talking about Toad's Place, Legendary Toad's Place, new book out about its famed history by Randall Beats with Brian Phelps, who runs the joint. So one part that interested me about this book, too, was that it's in some ways a business book. So here's my theory. So in the first half of the 20th century, a couple of local businesses found a way to hit a market and stay alive, because small businesses go out of business a lot, right? And you looked at Pepe's Pizza, Sally's Pizza, Louis Lunch. There are places, and then the Schubert Theater, where you kind of got the early look at Broadway shows, good theater before they go to New York. That was kind of a niche that made New Haven a fun place to hang out and do stuff that happened only in New Haven. And then they're all around today, because the people who ran them, whether it was Maurice, what's his name, at the Schubert, or the Consiglio family, or the Pepe families, they kind of figured out they were in touch, they were local, they knew their community, they knew how to keep the business viable and going, and it was real New Haven. I would argue that in the mid-70s, when New Haven was in somewhat of an economic downturn, that two other businesses started that were meeting a new generation. That was Claire's Cornucopia, that started as a narrow kind of head shop, soup and salad place, but a vegetarian, and Toad's Place, where more and more people are going out to see bands. Matter of fact, when I came to New Haven in 78, it was because of Toad's Place, really, that I wanted to come to New Haven. I looked around and I said, wow, I can go down the street from my dorm and see Meatloaf or Dave Van Rock. I mean, I used to go to New York to do that. You know, it's like, and then they found ways not only to meet a local market, but they kind of learned the business through trial and error when things changed, and they changed with the times. And today in 2021, they're still around 45 years later. And people come to New Haven because of those institutions. And when they think of those institutions, New Haven, in addition to pizza and the Schubert, they'll think of Claire's and they'll think of Toad's. Is that a fair way to put it?
It is. Jim Koplik, the promoter, said Toad's is a brand. It is. It has become a brand, and you know, it's iconic. And so people talk about it, and maybe even if they're, say, our age and don't go to the shows anymore, their kids will go. Maybe their grandkids will go just to be at Toad's and to go to the dance parties or to hear a new
band. You mentioned dance parties. So at the beginning, it didn't start with dance parties, right? It started out with Washboard Slim and kind of, you know, Pete Menta and his kind of rootsy acoustic music. They had some rock bands that are local. The Sims Brothers play there. But pretty soon it got to be a case where Bruce Springsteen would be in town. He'd come and jam, right? So it was kind of a fun place to do music. And Mike Sperndel, who started it, was very visionary. He was unstable with all the drugs, but he kind of had an idea of what would be popular and what kind of groups to get in. And then Brian Phelps learned under him how the business ran, and he'd have to like keep the lights on, pay the bills, keep people in, deal with problems. Like if a performer threw a snit and didn't show up, you give everybody free beers for the rest of the night. Or if you have a problem with the police, get to know the police and how you can deal with that. And he really did learn the business. He had to change with the times, as you show in the book. So like we used to go and it was like rock and pop and some reggae and kind of cool music. We'd heard of nationally, some locally. And then he switched to dance parties. So some people say, why are you doing that? Well, there were all these college kids around who liked to have a night or two a night where they just danced to recording music, and it was a scene. And that was something people wanted. And we became much more of a college nightlife town. And they rolled with that and succeeded. And then when they had to switch to doing more hip-hop and R&B at the turn of the century, they figured out how to do that and some of the security issues that were involved because there were fights. And I guess I was impressed with that. I was impressed with Brian as a business person, the way I'm so impressed with Claire Criscolo. A sort of a change, never know the city. They come in with their investors wanting a return, whether it's a newspaper that bought the New Haven Advocate, the New Haven Register, whether it was the company that bought WPLR and put it based on its metrics from some other state where you no longer have the personalities and the pick of music, and they no longer fill a function. They don't survive. But the local people who understand our community, what people want and what's going to make it work and are in there for the long haul, I think they're the ones who survive and make it.
Right, and Brian has always been very candid that the dance parties, the money they get from that is the bread and butter. I mean, yes, they still bring in bands a few nights a week, but especially Wednesday night has always been what they call WODES on campus, Wednesday night at Toad's. And the Yale students just love it. They love going in there and dancing and hooking up, and they don't care that they're not a live band, as long as they can dance.
So, Randy Beach, what were some of your favorite shows over the years that you saw at Toad's? Let's play that game.
Well, certainly when we discuss the Stones and Dylan, that'd be the top of the list. John Prine was a very special
guy. I wish I'd see him there. Someone called Sheet Music Hall. This Sunday I was at Cafe 9, which what I argue is the new cutting edge. It's not even new. It's a few decades in New Haven, the real cutting edge club in town where musicians love to play. They had a whole local musicians. He's doing John Prine songs for 3 hours on Sunday. That was really fun. Prine was a great performer.
He was. And I was one of the great things about Toad's was, and being at the New Haven Register, was sometimes I was able to get interviews with people. So I remember interviewing John Prine across Broadway, New Haven's Broadway, what was in the Holiday Inn, and he was just a sweetheart. And
is he? Because he seems so genuine. He's dead now.
He was absolutely genuine, and I found out he'd been a mailman in Chicago.
Yeah, that's how he got his start. He'd run home and write his songs.
I remember one of the funny things was he'd found out about Louis' Lunch. Oh, I want to go down to Louis' Lunch and get a hamburger. And unfortunately, it was one of the nights that Louis' Lunch was closed. He didn't get his hamburger. In retrospect, I wish I just had the time or the wherewithal just kind of hang out with him more. But, you know, you're
and the other thing is, you saw John Prine, who there's a genuinity to his music that if you're up close at a place like Toad's, you have this combination of enough of a crowd where it's exciting, where the artist feeds off it, and a fantastic sound system.
Yep.
But you're up close.
Yeah.
And you're really seeing how he's playing. You're seeing the reactions on his face. You're seeing how he plays guitar and how he reacts to the audience. Was it a good show?
It was a great show. It was he played his like illegal smile, and
I love that song.
He had the crowd singing along. You may see me tonight with an illegal smile. Don't cost there.
It's a good song to sing there.
Lasts a long while, and everyone singing along with it and hoisting their beers up. Maybe they were smoking joints. I don't know, but I remember it was just a lot of fun. And I was kind of discovering him. I mean, I had the album, that first album, which just had its 50th anniversary.
Yeah, that is an amazing album.
I didn't realize, like, through the years, I just really grew to treasure him more and more. And
me too. I still discover some songs. There were songs I hadn't known. They were playing Sunday. Oh, yeah. What are some other memorable shows at Toast for you?
A trio I really like was the Roaches.
Yes, that was one of my favorite ones ever.
R-O-C-H-E-S.
I remember, and sometimes the Toads is right when they're taking off, right? So, like, you're starting to hear about them, but they can still play a small club for five more minutes. And there's that excitement, too.
Yep.
And I remember that show at Toads. It was a big pack night. I think it was 1983, if I'm not mistaken, or two. And they had incredible harmonies, the Greenwich Village sound, but Robert Fripp was producing them, so it kind of had this experimental edge to it. You remember that?
I don't remember which show I saw there. They played there multiple
times.
They were always so funny. Mm-hmm. Their stage presence
great
was funny.
Yeah.
These three sisters loved each other, and their songs are so funny.
Powerful, too.
That was just very pleasurable, and I'm not sure if I even reviewed that show. But sometimes I would just be there as a fan, which was nice. Don't worry about it. Don't take notes. Just enjoy who's on stage.
Yeah, some of my favorites were Albert Collins, who was the Texas blues man. He played he tuned his electric guitar to D minor, and he just had this ice-picking sound that really felt like he was picking ice. Mm-hmm. And he had an extra-long chord, like five times the length, and he danced through the whole Toads crowd while he was playing this danceable blues that had his own kind of minor key to it. So Arlo Guthrie a couple times was fantastic, seeing him closer was really fun because I'd seen him in bigger places. Mm-hmm. Dylan, Michelle Schacht, when she was experimenting with a road tour that was going through traditional different forms of American music and updating it, but with original songs. And she was there with the band. I saw King Sunny Ade from Nigeria.
Oh, I saw that.
You saw that. That was fun. I remember you wrote about that. I think you talked about everybody was dancing in the room, which was so true. Steve Forbert, when he was on the rise in the late 70s, early 80s, and sort of like the next Dylan with a little more folk rock.
Yeah.
He did a fire on fire show. 999 was an English punk band. I remember when punk was coming in New Wave, and punk had come in New Wave, and they just ripped the place to shreds. And I remember I just felt like I'd been through a washing machine in a good way when that night was over. And the Go-Go's, when they were getting big, they were here at the last minute. Our Lips Are Sealed. Those are some of my favorites anyway.
And then Billy Joel was there at a two-night stand.
Right.
And,
did you go to that one? I didn't see that one.
I saw the first show, and he was kind of a jerk, frankly. I mean, he put on a good show. People were happy, but he had this rule, no photos of me. No photos of you? Are you kidding? Not even by the media. So photographers, like for the register.
Nowadays, you got cell phones.
they had to sneak their equipment in, strapping it to their bodies. And then when Billy Joel started his show and they pull out their equipment to try to photograph it, they get bounced out of there. And come on, Billy, what's your problem? So I remember we had to run a file photo of the guy. And the last thing he said at the end of his first show was, "Don't take no shit from nobody." And I wrote, well, we had to take it from him.
But you did get to go, and I did too at the same time. I used to love reviewing shows at Toads. I don't know anymore, but you know, at the New Haven Advocate and the L Daily before that, I used to love getting in free to those shows that, you know, because I was in my late teens, early 20s. I couldn't believe I get to see all these great artists and write about them, and it was really fun.
It was.
Now, you had to convince the Register to start a rock beat because the Register was a conservative, old school daily. It was the mid-70s, and this thing was happening in America where it wasn't just anymore the kids and not just the liberals or lefties who were going to Woodstock. Everybody was getting into this music and going out to see it, and daily newspapers were kind of behind the ball on it. What did you have to do to convince the New Haven Register to let you start covering shows at Toads?
I don't recall any arguments. I mean, I guess it's a pretty easy case for me to make because I would continue to cover, I was covering maybe West Haven then, or maybe I'd made it to City Side. Cover Yale, but I said I'll do this on my own time, and so you'll get my daily stories out of my beat, and then I'll do this stuff at night. And these guys were different generations; they didn't really get who the bands were, but I convinced them that this was a coming thing, and they'd get more readership that way, more buzz. So they rather easily agreed to it, and I knew I would enjoy it, and I knew I'd get free tickets. Get to do some interviews with these musicians I really liked. So
I remember talking to the city editor at the time, Tom Hubbard, who's saying The Advocate, which was the alternative weekly, isn't around anymore because it got bought by a big corporation that ran to the ground. He was saying how The Advocate was starting. It started, grew out of the underground papers with the alternative press starting in America. And just like Toads and just like the rock clubs, the counterculture institutions were becoming mainstream to some extent. I think America made a bargain with capitalism, which is that hedonistic liberalism and leftism was okay as long as it didn't interfere with profit. So it's fine to do drugs, drop out, listen to rock music, as long as capitalism thrived.
Right.
So the alternative press, unlike the underground press, made a lot of money. One way it made money, I remember Tom Hubbard looking at it and saying, they do all that art stuff. New Haven's got all this arts and culture, and they're all over it. And I remember that, you know, we used to, half our paper was arts because I went over to The Advocate. And I think Toads would spend thousands of dollars a week, you know, on ads there eventually, because that's sort of where they found out about the shows and where they read about them a lot. Yeah.
Right. Rick Allison was a DJ at PLR at the time. And when I interviewed him for the book, he said, you had this great thing coming together. The drinking age was 18. You had PLR pumping up the shows.
And even 18 was fungible. I was with some friends who weren't yet 18 when I first went to Toads. I was 18. They said, hey, you want to come in? We'll let you in free. And they didn't ask to see IDs. You know, it was pretty easy to get in. Yeah.
But he said, you had this, you've got Toads, you've got PLR, here's Cutler's Records around the corner, the great music coming out, Advocate, New Haven Register now on board talking about writing about this. It was just a perfect time, and it can never be repeated. You won't ever have that series of that synergy.
The other thing
again.
I thought about it also is that generation and that form of business, they called it hip capitalism, like the Advocate or PLR or the Toads, catering to a market that now was coming above ground, right?
Yeah.
And at what extent did they become the mainstream? At what extent are they still countercultural? And I guess I would argue that the Toads became mainstream. That's not bad. So like mainstream corporate journalism, there are great reporters in mainstream corporate journalism. The people in the counterculture aren't better. They're just different. Right. And I think that's kind of what happened to Toads, because the counterculture is really a Cafe 9 now. Right,
yeah. Toads is not so cutting edge as it was.
Although, I will say that a couple of years ago, I'd never heard of this person, Cardi B. Right, stripper turned rapper.
Uh-huh.
And I had an intern who said, you know, I'm really interested in this person on social media, Cardi B. Toads has her. So he went and did a review for me. He said she's going to be the next big thing. Six months later, she was an A-list celebrity. Major record. So it happened again with Toads.
That's brought in Toads Cardi tradition. B.
And he picked up on how the crowd related to her. But in fact, Randy, when you and I talked about our favorite shows, they were all up in the 80s into early 90s, 70s to the early 90s.
I know.
But they're still around. So what is Toads now? How did they survive, and what's next for them?
Again, the dance parties remain, I believe, the bread and butter. But Brian is savvy enough to know who the up-and-coming bands are and to get them booked. And Jimmy Koplik helps him out, too. Jimmy's with Live Nation, and he and Brian worked together on some of this.
So is Brian back open after
the Toads
COVID? He got the money.
Toads reopened in August, and they're very good about you must be vaccinated or show us a test.
At Cafe 9, we had to show our vaccination card to get in, which made me feel good. I'm actually going to Schubert to see this weekend. Carol and I, my wife and I, are going to see Patty Griffin and Gregory Alan Isakoff. And again, you got to show your card, which makes us all feel good about going.
Right.
I actually felt safe at Cafe 9, even though it was packed, knowing that everyone had to show that card.
Yeah, so Brian knows that, and he's been very good about enforcing it.
It's funny, when I deal with him and also the people in their place, I'm always very impressed with the skill. It's actually a lot of skill between running a nightclub that's successful. The sound quality, unruly people, down to like having your drinks ordered, right? You can't run out of drinks, to dealing with the police. Right. I remember they used to play The Tide Is High by Blondie on the sound system anytime liquor control was coming to find underage people. Then they'd open the back door and everybody would run out.
Oh,
you know,
really?
You kind of have to know you have to know a lot of little parts of how to run business, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that they're very successful that way. You know, the other thing of business, the time I figured out that Brian Phelps was a brilliant business person, I'll tell you a little story. It was 2005. And I started The Independent as just this little online counterculture, online-only, new kind of alternative media. And I was sitting in his office at night, He said, I want to help you out and give you some advertising. And I said, well, is it going to help you at all to give me ads? He said, no. He said, I used to spend thousands of dollars a week with you and the Advocate. I don't do any of that anymore. Here's what I do. And meanwhile, there were two shows going on at once. There was a packed house downstairs, and he'd hooked up with this brilliant young promoter named Manic Mark, who had another show going to Lilyplad with people half the age of the people downstairs. So, Brian, let me tell you what I do. I have an email list of everyone who's ever come. So when I have a show, I send it there. I have a list of every kid at Yale. I send it there. And here's what I spend. I overspend on Facebook. And this is before everyone understood about digital marketing, which is now de rigueur. He said, I can go on Facebook and find out every college kid within 40 miles who likes the band who's there. And I could do that for like no money. But if I really splurge and spend $100, I'll be at the top of all their feeds. So there's absolutely no reason. So I said, don't give me a cent. Because, you know, I was building a business model that, you know, it has to make sense for the people who support it. So it's philanthropic, NPR style. Right. As was nice of him, he wanted to support, but it wasn't going to help him. So it wasn't like a long-term thing. But I realized he was ahead of everybody. He was ahead of everybody. And that's one reason I think he was staying in business there. And he got, it was a more effective way than ever, which is why I kind of am not down on what's happened with media, because it should work out the best way to get promote. And that's how I believe that's how in the 2000s and in the aughts and into the 20s, I believe that's how Brian has kept it viable. That's someone who understands business and can watch the changes.
Right. And when we were at Globe Pequot in Guilford trying to get them to publish the book, one of the questions they asked, well, how are you on social media? And he gave them the right answer. I've got this many people on Facebook. I've got the website.
And the other business brilliance that comes out in your book is how he deals with Yale. So they're smack in the middle of Yale.
Right.
They're the only 2 inches of that area that Yale doesn't own and control. So right. That makes Yale nuts, right? They yes. want to control that. So they're always trying to find ways to get his building and stop having toads there. Even though it's as I told you, I went to Yale partly because I wanted to go to Toads. I'm totally serious. I wasn't that interested in like applying to Yale, stuff like that. And New Haven looked kind of fun. And Yale tried to take their building away. They tried to get rid of their fire exit, tried to get the fire department to stop them where they blocked the egress. They did all this stuff to get the city on them, and it never worked. And right. then they bid for the building when they were renting it, right? And then in your book, you said he had first right of refusal. He was right. able to match, through his good business skills, was able to match the money Yale was putting up and had to write to keep the building.
Right.
And I love the fact that that's standing there and that Yale can't stop them.
Oh, it's sweet. how many businesses have we seen forced out by Yale mom and pop stores and Toads?
And that Yale, it doesn't just belong to Yale, just 3/4 of it downtown.
Say?
I'm just saying it shows that they don't control every inch of the city.
Right. They can't
and
own,
what we want to do.
They own our whole town.
And yet he goes to Maury's. He loves Yale. And Brian Sperndel, my other favorite part of the book, was Brian Sperndel, this kind of druggy counterculture guy, really wanted to be admitted. What was it, the Brantford Yacht Club?
Yeah.
That was pathetic, I got to tell you. He wanted to be accepted by the starched shirt, boring, elite people of Brantford.
He might have been the Pine Orchard.
Oh, Pine Orchard, okay. Yeah. And he got in, and he was so excited.
Yeah, and he brings
he in... He wanted to be respectable.
Brings in a couple members of NRBQ, and they're all strutting around saying, hey, here's my club. Come on, I'll show you my club. he came out of a poor background or middle-class background in Ohio, and this was the bright lights, and this was the elite, and so he wanted to be...
It has to be the most boring place on earth. Man, where would you rather be, watching John Prine at Toads or falling asleep with gin and tonics at the Pine Orchard Yacht Club?
Yeah, but he would just, you know, they weren't like the other people there. They would knock back their drinks and carry on and laugh, and maybe the members regretted letting Sperndel in, but he actually did play golf. I mean, his friends were saying, you're not a very good golf player, but he just liked riding around the golf cart, and he was just having a ball. He knew how to have a good time, Mike did.
So Toad's Place, the story has now been told. Randy Beats has told it, along with Brian Phelps, who kept the place going. And you can read about it. In addition to reading about Toad's, what you will like to do, if you're like me, is look at the pictures of Joan Jett and all the other different people who came in over the years, and then go to the back and look at all the concerts and try to remember the ones you've been at. Randall Beach, what a pleasure. I'm so glad that even though you retired from the Register, you're still in the game doing your writing at Connecticut Magazine and writing this book. And it's great to have you around town.
Thanks,
and
Paul.
And so everyone, if you want to get this book, how do you get it, Randy? Do you go to...
You go to the Toad's website and you can get it through there and get it through Amazon. It's just out there. It's also in bookstores now. RJ Julia Booksellers has it in Madison. The Yale Bookstore has it.
All right, so you can't not get it, okay? So the legendary Toad's Place, Stories from New Haven's famed music venue, Brian Phelps and Randall Beach, it's out! So you can get it. Thank you, Randy, for coming on today.
Thanks, Paul, for having me on.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us on Dateline New Haven. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us all day and all night long at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.